And this is KPCW. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Thursday morning. It's February 19th. Day to dig out because we've got some clouds, but mostly sunny skies and just 5 degrees now in Old Town Park City. Heber City reporting 8 degrees. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Thursday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Thursday. We are definitely waking up to some wintry conditions out there. The main snow has stopped falling, but we could have a couple of passing flurries and snow showers through the day. Otherwise, it's just frigid out there. Temperatures down into the teens and single digits this morning. We'll turn to temperatures only warming up into the upper 20s for us as we get towards places like Park City. We'll see temperatures only in the upper 20s to near 30 as we get towards the Heber Valley, but definitely some cold temperatures expected out there. Now, as we go throughout most of the day, it should remain, again, just a minus a flurry or a snow shower, mainly dry. But by the time we move into tonight, yeah, we've got some more moisture moving in with a new storm system arriving. Most of that will affect places in central and southern Utah, but we will have a chance of seeing overnight Thursday and early Friday morning that chance of some of that moisture moving north, and that could produce a period of accumulating snow. So the potential of a couple of inches of new fresh snow arriving overnight tonight into Friday morning, very possible. Not as significant as what we just saw by any means, but still, a fresh coat of snow could be added to everything out there for both the Heber Valley and in the Park City area. As we go throughout the day on your Friday, look for periods of light snow to be continued possible. Temperatures, again, only warming into the mid-20s for us in the Park City area, upper 20s in the Heber Valley, and again, we could see some light accumulations of an additional inch or two. So all said and done, we could see anywhere from 2 to 5 inches of snow as we go throughout late tonight and throughout your Friday. Now, thankfully, that's going to be the last of the big winter storms moving through the area. Heading into the weekend, we've got sunshine on the return. It'll be great for folks getting out, exploring all those wintry conditions. High temperatures back into the mid-30s in Park City on Saturday, upper 30s in the Heber Valley, and we should be back into the low to mid-40s for highs in both Park City and the Heber Valley by your Sunday with mostly sunny skies. Our next storm system does not look to arrive until the middle of next week. That's the latest forecast from the ABC 4 Forecast Center. I'm meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
With a look in the backcountry on the phone with us, we've got Nikki from the Utah Avalanche Center. Good morning, Nikki.
Good morning. So we have an avalanche warning that remains in place for most of the state. That includes northern, central, southwestern, and southeastern Idaho, even in southeastern Utah and even southeastern Idaho. As I just said, we had this huge winter storm, dropped up to 40 inches of snow in favored areas like the upper Cottonwoods, up to 30 inches of snow on the Park City Ridgeline. And yesterday we saw a lot of avalanche activity because of it. Backcountry skiers reported really sensitive snow and widespread avalanches. We had about 12 avalanches come into the Avalanche Center so far, and I would guess that that only captures a fraction of what was actually going on because conditions weren't great to travel. Today we're going to remain at a high danger. That new snowfall and all the strong winds have created very dangerous avalanche conditions. People want to be careful when they're traveling into wind-drifted snow or wind-drifted areas. Both natural and human-triggered avalanches are going to be likely today. And with the clearer weather, folks might be tempted, but remember that the avalanche danger remains high, and it's going to remain high for the next few days. So most avalanche accidents occur after peak instability. There's great riding to be had on lower angle slopes.
Okay, so stay below 30, yeah?
Yep. Today you can stay off slopes steeper than 30 degrees and make sure you're not on slopes that are connected to or below anything steeper than 30.
Okay, well, you guys be safe out there too. Thank you. Stay tuned. In just a minute here, we'll be checking in with Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation CEO Colin Hilton. He's calling in from Italy with his impression of the Milan Cortina Games. Snow Survey Supervisor Jordan Clayton has an outlook of the state's water supply with all of this new snow. And finally, Peruvian filmmaker Augusto Zagar, brother of Park City Councilmember Diego, will be in with details on his new film that's screening tonight, 7 p.m. at the Chimsani Auditorium, Runa Simi. It's a free screening and again starts at 7 o'clock. Then stay tuned for Cool Science Radio. Today's guests include University of Utah geologist William Johnson, who discusses the discovery of a hidden pressurized freshwater aquifer beneath the Great Salt Lake and what it could mean for dust control and the lake's future. Then the Economist magazine's science correspondent Matt Kaplan talks about his new book, I Told You So, and the scientists who were ridiculed, sidelined, or punished for advancing ideas that later proved correct. All of that coming up on Cool Science Radio, heard, of course, every Thursday at 9 a.m. Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation CEO Colin Hilton is in Italy attending the 2026 Winter Olympics, studying firsthand what it takes to host a modern Olympic Games. Hilton also helped lead Utah's successful 2002 Winter Olympics. He joins us now on the phone to discuss what he's learning and how it could shape Utah's preparations for 2034. Well, good afternoon to you, Colin. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Leslie. I'm on day 16 of 18.
Okay. Oh, wow. All right. So, I mean, you were there for opening ceremony or a few days before?
Yeah, a few days before. We have about a delegation of about 80 folks from Utah spread out over four waves of people. And we started about 4 days before opening ceremonies with some of the official observer programs.
Okay, so as you kind of observe the Milan Cortina Games, what are you paying closest attention to that could shape Utah's preparations for 2034?
Well, a lot, as I think your intro pointed out, I've been a part of several Olympic Games before. So a big part of this for our organizing committee was to really introduce a lot of our transportation planners from UDOT and UTA were in that initial wave ahead of the games to sort of meet up with our counterparts. Carlos Braceras from UDOT obviously got to meet with the planners from Milan, along with Jay Fox, on sort of the equivalent of what UTA does. Our University of Utah folks, of course, with them hosting the opening and closing ceremonies, they were able to go to the rehearsal and kind of see all of the details of what it takes to prepare and practice for the opening ceremonies. So different waves of our delegates that were here were really keying in on different areas. We had a lot of our destination management organizations like Jennifer Wesselhoff from the Park City Visitors and Convention Bureau. We had Sarah Tolliver from Ogden and Caitlin Escalin from Visit Salt Lake, who were also sort of meeting with her counterparts to see how they had worked in the years leading up to and through the game. So my job, in part with others with the organizing committee, was really to introduce and guide them around the games and help explain what they were seeing, so that we hope what that will provide is a great opportunity to have them more knowledgeable as they're in the planning phase, being 8 years out, and to hope for really context of what they're planning for and the feedback they received when we set them up with their counterparts.
Yeah, and it seems just so different than what Salt Lake has. I mean, those venues are spread, I've heard, you know, sometimes 6 hours between different venues. We don't have anything like that. I mean, what, Snow Basin's going to be the furthest away?
Yeah, I mean, that is an advantage for Utah to have everything within a 1 hour's drive of one village. So certainly we have that geographic advantage. But a lot of the regions have clusters of venues that it was good to see just in Milan, the ice venues and how people were moving and going between the venues. We brought Deidre Walsh from Park City Mountain, Todd Bennett from Deer Valley, and Davey Ratchford from Snow Basin. We took them up to Bormio and Livigno to see the alpine and freestyle and snowboard events. And especially Livigno had just a wonderful setup of a cluster of five venues and one common area and a walking distance to their downtown, which obviously is similar to what we have here in Park City with Snow Park Lodge and the Mountain Base Center for Park City and Main Street. So they were glad to see, again, a modern version. We all think we've done that in '02, but there really is some new elements to these games that the live sites are, you know, very entertaining to engage the public who maybe don't have tickets. So I think it was good for our resort partners to see that, see the necessary needs for snowmaking, and having experienced teams, which we saw in Bormio, they hold a Alpine World Cup every year. And that knowledge, much like we do when we host annual World Cups, really made a difference in how the event was pulled off. And the Italians used a lot of their iconic venues to do that.
Yeah. And as you recall, I mean, we had real large parking lots there at Soldier Hollow, there at the base of the Utah Olympic Park, and then along US 40. So is that the plan still today to try to keep cars out of the, you know, the venue areas?
Certainly to keep cars from coming into and parking at venues. We did not do that back then. We did park and rides, and we're actually looking at really even improved public transit systems that would allow sort of our Salt Lake-based spectators to take a bus system rather than driving up to the park and ride lots. So, you know, those are the movement by buses and, you know, who knows what we're using in 8 years. I think we'll have, you know, we'll get into that more detailed transportation planning later. And this effort being 8 years out is more for a lot of our elected officials. We obviously had Mayor Ryan Dickey and Tana and Tanya Hansen from the county here. And you know, a lot of the legacy and impact sessions that we met with our Milan Cortina counterparts really helped them focus on what cities and counties should be thinking about in terms of setting goals tied to the games. And I think that is, I think our elected officials from our local governments were really interested to hear about how the goals were set and how they acted on those. And we are just really lucky to have a significant lead up time to 2034. And I think it allows us to really be very visionary in what we are looking to do. And as we all know, living in Park City, Summit County, or even in the Heber Valley, transportation and movement of people is something we need to improve on every day. And the games can be a catalyst to really get those projects done ahead of 2034 and take advantage of public transit and transportation systems that we need every day, but apply them for use during the games.
Yeah. So has much changed with security at the Olympics? Of course, we remember in 2002, we were just months off of the 2011 catastrophe and really saw things change as a result. Are those just systems still in place?
The systems are still in check and still similar to what we saw in 02. Maybe less visible than what we had right after 9/11 leading up to 02. I think the Italian government and police have done a really good job to provide that security check of the mag and bag going into venues. There's certainly a presence as you move around on the train system and the metro systems in Milan here. And it makes everybody feel safe, but it's not overbearing. And I think they found a really good balance so far, and it hasn't been a topic. So it's there, but not overly burdensome.
Yeah. Something I noticed is just that the medal ceremonies are happening right after the events there in Italy. here in O2, we had, it was a ticketed event, as I recall, but free tickets, and we had metal events and, like, live music. I mean, I remember seeing the Dave Matthews Band. Is that something that we're, you're going to repeat?
Yes, and I think it is a sort of element because of our close proximity of the venues to a central place like downtown Salt Lake. That Metals Plaza, which was held just kitty corner to where the Delta Center is and a big open parking lot there. We have plans to do that as well, to do a flower ceremony after each of the competitions for the athletes to have an immediate recognition, but to wait till the end of the day in the evening to do the official presentation of the awards and the medals, and then to have a concert after that. So we absolutely are planning on doing that again. I think here in Milan, because of the geography of being in all different parts of Italy, they couldn't do that. And so we will do that and add one twist. We're actually going to bring a mountain sport of big air ski and snowboard down into the Metals Plaza and actually have a competition venue right there in downtown. So we want to mix it up a little bit. We don't want to do a redo of O2. And those are some of the twists that we will look to plan over the next 8 years.
Hmm. So what were the challenges in O2 that the committee intends to approach differently this time around?
One of the favorite ones we bring up quite a bit. I think in O2, we had sort of a central food and beverage setup, and we sort of had a vendor that supplied the same food at each of the venues. And there was a consistency of one concessionaire to do that. In retrospect, if you're going to go to Deer Valley, you need to have turkey chili, right? It is unique to that venue, and we should use the sort of the food and beverage uniqueness at each of those locations. So we are making those kind of changes to provide a little bit of uniqueness at the different experiences of the venues, and utilizing the talents of our great ski resorts with great offerings of different food and beverage. And so that's one thing that is an easy one to point out. And I think also getting more cars off the road, more reliance on public and bus shuttle systems, I think, including from Salt Lake. We did it a little bit, but not a lot. I think we will ratchet that up. And again, I think what we're mostly encouraging our community and local government partners to do right now is to think of the things that will really improve everyday needs in the community and use the games as a date certain in the future to really, you know, allow these visiony ideas to be acted on and have a deadline. I keep telling our elected officials, deadlines are good for local government, and the date of the games is not going to move. So what are those key aspirational elements, whether they're infrastructure or programs? What can we achieve? And set a date, set a plan, set the goal, and get everybody working towards that. So the focus of the group coming over here was very much to get our community leaders really seeing the opportunity of what the games provide as an opportunity to make some really good improvements. And I think they have been inspired just on what they have seen here.
Yeah. Now, Park City Mountain, of course, integral into getting to the Olympics to Utah. After hosting, right, more than a decade of World Cup races, my understanding that none of the Alpine events will be held at Park City Mountain. Are the venues locked down, or is there a chance to host the slalom and GS here in Park City again? It just doesn't seem right.
Well, we actually have 40% more events than we did in O2, so we really do need to have each venue actually step up and provide more days of competition. So Alpine and O2 was in three different venues. We had the speed events down in Snow Basin, and we had the GS at Park City and the slalom at Deer Valley. That has never occurred since O2. And right now, our plan is to do all Alpine events at Snow Basin, to do the freestyle aerials and moguls at Deer Valley at Snow Park, and to do slopestyle halfpipe cross events at Park City Mountain. And there's more events, so we really can't do that. And the ski techs and everything for Alpine would like to be in one location. So right now the plan is everything at Snow Basin for Alpine, but some incredible events. We did not have events like slopestyle. So that is going to be an event that I think fits the culture and location of Park City Mountain.
All right. Utah, of course, has emphasized using its existing venues for 2034. How does the Milan Cortina model compare in terms of sustainability and infrastructure use? As you mentioned, they've got a World Cup there every year.
Yeah, and I think I think Italy did, even though the venues are spread out, they've gone to venues that are used in the World Cup circuit all the time. Up in Anholtz is where the biathlon venue, and that is annually like the Super Bowl of biathlon. It is the most famous and one of the best venues on the World Cup circuit. So that was a natural to go there. The women in Cortina for Alpine, obviously that is a regular stop. The men in Bormio for Alpine is a regular stop. Livigno is kind of their new location to put a lot of the ski and the freestyle and snowboard events. And that town really got on board and worked with the organizing committee and made a really compelling environment for those events. And they have an interest to be a regular event host in the future.
Okay, I guess looking overall, I mean, what grade would you give the Milan Cortina Games?
I would say an A, especially with a lot of the timing challenges they had. They pulled it off. They got everything open. The fields of play and the competitions have run really smoothly. There has been just nothing but excitement in the venues and the cities that I've gone to. So I'm super pleased. It's good for the movement and super good to see.
Yeah. And once home, I mean, will there be some kind of community gathering with photos? And, you know, Miles Reiterman was so good at it. Is there something going to be like that once you get back?
Yeah, I think everyone's just getting back right now. It was a bit interesting to see our texts of everybody coming back home during that snowstorm you had yesterday. So everybody was both excited to see the snow happening there. But we all committed. We do need to decompress. We actually still have a few more days for a few of us that are still here. But we're going to gather and kind of collect our thoughts. And absolutely, I think we'll find a way to give a report. I think each of the different entities will have a different means of how they do that. But we absolutely are going to gather up and share, if you will, what the lessons learned were.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Just that big kudos to the teams at the Utah Olympic Park and Park City and Deer Valley, all the Soldier Hollow, you know, a lot of the athletes that are over here competing have trained at those facilities. And we're just really grateful for our staff that helped Team USA do their performances here in Italy.
Okay. Colin Hilton is the CEO of the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation. Thanks so much for your time.
Yep. Thanks, Leslie. Have a good day.
Well, Heber City leaders have their eyes on several tax-related bills that state lawmakers are considering this winter. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has the legislation that could affect the Wasatch Back this session.
Halfway through Utah's 45-day legislative session, lawmakers have filed roughly 900 bills. Heber City Manager Matt Brower says city leaders are monitoring several bills that could affect property taxes in the valley. Senate Bill 97 would limit how much property tax revenue cities can keep in reserve. It would also prevent cities from using leftover property tax revenue for infrastructure projects or other capital improvements. Brower told the city council at a meeting Tuesday that would be a change for Heber.
Remember, our policy is that when we do have reserves in excess of the state mandate, we transfer that over to pay for projects like you did on the Heritage Farms Parkway. According to this bill, that could no longer happen.
Heritage Farms Parkway is the new road that travels east around downtown. Another proposed piece of legislation, House Bill 236, would require public hearings for tax increases to happen sooner. Right now, Heber City has budget discussions in June, and if a tax increase is needed, a truth and taxation hearing is typically in August. If this bill becomes law, Heber would instead be required to finish its tax hearings in the springtime. Representative Karen Peterson, the Davis County Republican sponsoring the bill, says it's meant to create more transparency for taxpayers. State lawmakers are also considering House Bill 365, which would change taxation notification requirements. Brower says the bill would require Heber to announce its intent to raise taxes before having in-depth budget discussions.
This, in my mind's eye, is putting the cart before the horse, because we've really not gone through the budget process with you.
Utah's 2026 general session ends March 6th. Heber City is a financial supporter of KPCW. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
As of February 1st, Utah's snowpack had fallen into record poor territory, but with the storms this week, has it made a difference? On the phone with an outlook of the state's water supply, I have Jordan Clayton. He is Utah's snow survey supervisor, is also a data collection officer. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so you publish a statewide monthly snow water equivalent report. In the February 1st report, that total dropped below the previous historic minimum and has continued setting daily record lows for this time of year based on data going back to 1980. So how unusual is it to see new record minimums being set day after day like this?
Yeah, well, it's unprecedented. Thankfully, in this storm cycle that we're just coming out of at this point, we've now entered back into the range of previous observations, meaning that we're not setting records anymore, but we're still in the bottom fourth percentile of observations. So another way of saying that is that about 95% of the time, the state has seen more snowpack than it's seen as of right now. That's unfortunately still, that's including the snow that we just got. So we're not breaking records anymore for record low snow, but we're still in the bottom like 5% of what we've seen in the past.
Wow. So looking at the report, it sounds like we're sitting at about 56% of median statewide snow water equivalent. What does that number mean in practical terms for water users?
Yeah, so it, of course, varies basin by basin. That number has increased to 64% of median. What it's essentially is just showing is the promise of having what we would call a normal winter relative to this year. And we have a certain amount of time that we can make up that distance and make up the amount of snow that we have not yet received. It's a little bit over a month until we typically get to our peak snowpack for the state of Utah. So there's a long way to go. We can use all these different indexes for the different basins around the state, but statewide picture is, as you mentioned, kind of in the 50 to 60% or so of normal range.
Mm-hmm. And your projections show that there's only a 10% chance of reaching a normal peak snowpack this winter. What kind of storm pattern would it take to significantly change that outlook?
Yeah, good statewide storms like the one we just received are exactly the solution. So either that kind of onshore flow, that zonal flow that comes directly from the West Coast, or these juicy northwestern storms that come down northwest-oriented to southeast, those do a pretty good job in a lot of cases delivering a lot of moisture. And they tend to be, especially if they're coming from the north, tend to be a little bit colder, and that's what we need in these storms. But this storm system, when we look at the updated 2 to 3 day totals, when we particularly focus on the water equivalent of the snowpack, a lot of areas around the state received between around 0.7 inches of snow water equivalent to, in some cases, over 3 inches, which is excellent. But statewide, it would probably be closer to a little over 1 to 1.5 inches on average. And that's not going to do it. We need about maybe 6 to 8 more of those storms to get back to what we'd call a normal winter.
Hmm. So despite the snow deficit, some indicators are less dire. January precipitation in Utah below normal at 75%, but the state's water year-to-date precipitation still close to normal, I read, about 96% of median. So how is that? It's come in the form of rain rather than snow?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's also been an interesting case of timing. So we call the water year a water year because it starts, and instead of in the calendar year, it starts on October 1st and it ends on September 30th. And coincident with the beginning of October was a lot of really wet activity for the state of Utah, some pretty nice storms. Of course, those were rain and not snow, as you just mentioned. And so that really boosted our water year-to-date totals because those early October events, and they count. It's a total accumulation from that October date forward that we are considering. So it's a little bit tricky because that water that was delivered in early October isn't necessarily particularly relevant when we think about how much water we're going to get when all the snow melts and how much that's going to affect runoff. And so that can be a little bit deceiving when we see those really high precipitation numbers. Now, we did also receive some really abundant moisture around the end of the calendar year, around Christmas time to early January. And that was also much more liquid than solid. We had really high snow levels in that system, up to around 10,000 feet in some cases. And so there's also been precipitation at a time that would normally be snow that hasn't been this year because of the really anomalously warm conditions.
Yeah. So again, tell us how that impacts the filling reservoirs and stuff. Again, when the moisture is coming in terms of rain as opposed to snow, it keeps the soil moisture wet, but it doesn't do a lot for filling reservoirs, or how does that work?
Yeah, that's a good question. So when we look at our forecast, which is an effort to figure out how much total water in terms of a volume of water we're going to get when all that snow melts, and we typically think of the period from the beginning of April through the end of July as being that period where we get all that water from our mountains. And when we look at the forecast in terms of the volumes of water, we can compare those to the past and see how they compare to percent of normal, that kind of thing. And the reservoir inflow, for example, for Echo Reservoir, even in the unlikely case that we get an unusual amount of runoff from the snowmelt, if we exceed like a only 10% chance expectation, we would still not get to average flow for Echo Reservoir inflow. As a more sort of expected value, the 50th exceedance probability forecast for Echo Reservoir inflow is about 80,000 acre feet. And that's kind of the most probable. It's a range of probabilities that can happen in each one of these forecast points. But if we look at the middle one, it is the most probable that it would land somewhere near there. And 80,000 acre feet for Echo Reservoir inflow would be roughly 55% of normal. And so just to put in perspective that these inflow numbers are expected to be low from this year.
Yeah, so for the communities on the Wasatch Back that do rely heavily on this snowmelt, what does that mean, a 40 to 50% of normal runoff for local reservoirs as well as for the municipal supply?
Right, so it's going to be a tough year for managing a limited water supply, and we do... In our water supply outlook reports, we do include what's called a surface water supply index, which examines the overall amount of water that we expect to get from runoff, and it compares it with the existing water in the reservoir systems for different areas of the state. And so that's a good way for us to approximate, again, what the water supplies are going to be, not just in the Park City, Wasatch Back area, but around the state. But when we do look at, for example, the Weber, the Weber system should be around the 21st percentile for water supplies this coming summer. That's the whole Weber system, so it's a little bit inclusive of areas that you're not asking about. But just to put that number in perspective, around 80% of the time, there would be more abundant surface water supplies for everything that the state needs, for your area needs, agriculture, municipal use, everything. Most of the time, about 80% of the time, we anticipate there would have been more water than we expect this coming runoff season.
So if we don't see these significant storms soon, like you're saying, we need at least 6 to 8 of them to help things out. I guess when would water managers along the Wasatch Back need to begin making operational adjustments?
Yeah, I want to be a little bit more specific to the East Canyon area for a second, because when I mentioned the like 6 or so storms, that was a statewide picture. When we talk about the East Canyon sub-basin, we're actually still breaking records for low snowpack, even after the storm system that just rolled through. We're still outside of the range of previous observations for the 3 or 4 sites that are used for that basin. So it's not like we have an abundant number of snowtall sites for that system. But I mention all that because, specific to your area, we're still dealing with really, really anomalous, in fact, unprecedented poor snow. And so the managing of that scarce resource is going to have to be very careful this summer.
And I guess how closely should residents and irrigation users here in Summit and Wasatch Counties be watching kind of those March and early April snowpack numbers?
Yeah, well, I'm a little biased because I work for the snow survey. So I would think people should care about our data. But I mean, in cases like this where we have a really, especially in years when we have really abundant snow or really poor snow, it's even more critical to be monitoring the snow till system, to be monitoring what we expect in terms of the runoff from those snow measurement systems. And at any time, if anyone has questions about how to interpret the data or you know what the data are showing, those kinds of things, please reach out to us. We're a branch of the USDA. We're the NRCS. And part of our job is to help people interpret the data. And so you can most easily just use your favorite search engine and look up Utah Snow Survey NRCS. And it'll take you right to our homepage, and it has our contact information right down there.
Okay. Appreciate that information. And I guess I wanted to ask about these projected stream flows. I mean, how do they compare to the average years and to the drought years of 2021 or 2022?
Yeah, that's a good question. We're right now not really sure because we're still kind of early in the forecast season. And I don't mean to sort of sidestep your question, but we do get more and more confidence in these runoff predictions as we get closer to April 1st. And so we'll issue new forecasts on March 1st and that report. And then the ones that are of highest confidence are the ones that come out in April 1st because, you know, understandably, now we know more or less what the peak snowpack is going to be. We know what conditions are looking like in the reservoir system as of those dates. When we go back to years like 2018, which was a particularly poor snowpack year, we are seeing a close analog with this year in 2018 in many areas around the state. So those might be good runoff numbers to compare against. But I guess what I'm saying is it's a little bit early in the season to know for sure. We'll have more confidence as we move forward in these coming weeks.
Yeah. And kind of just based on some of the models that we have seen where the snowpack is going to be rising higher and higher in elevation, that really still is the critical factor, snowpack. I mean, can strong precipitation meaningfully offset that snow deficit or not really?
Well, it definitely helps. Yeah, that's a really good question. What we've seen is that the pulse of water that we get when our snow melts is a really good way to bring that water into our reservoirs. It's an efficient way to bring that water downstream. And part of the reason why is that when we have that day-after-day onslaught of water into our headwaters when the snow is melting, the system tends to saturate or at least come close to it, which means that a larger proportion of the water makes it downstream and a smaller proportion of it sort of stays in the headwaters and is used to saturate those headwaters. And so the difference between the snow melt, which tends to be concentrated over a short period and then saturates the system, and rain, which is obviously helpful, but it tends not to saturate the system or tends to be separated over a long period of time from one storm to the next. It just doesn't produce as much water in our meaningful increases in stream flow or as much water inflow into our reservoirs. And so one of the reasons why we really love the summer precipitation, for example, is that it helps keep our mountain soils moist. It does a lot to decrease how much people withdraw from reservoirs. But in terms of actually replenishing the water in the reservoir system, by far the majority of that comes from our snow melt.
Okay, Jordan, I'm out of time. I appreciate your time. Thank you. We'll look forward to that March 1st report.
Thanks for having me.
Jordan Clayton, again, is the Utah Snow Survey Supervisor and Data Collection Officer. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Fresh off the Toronto Film Festival, Augusto Zigarra is here in Park City, not only to visit his brother Diego, but also to screen his award-winning documentary, Runasima. It'll be screening tonight for free at 7 p.m. at the Jim Santee Auditorium. Augusto joins us now in the studio. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Leslie. Thank you so much for inviting me to be able to speak in your space, and I'm really excited to be here in Park City again, and especially now with my film, Runasimi, with our film that we've been working for so long, and really excited to share it with the community tonight.
Okay, so what does Runasimi mean?
Runasimi means language of the people, and that's in Quechua. So a Quechuan will tell you, let me tell it to you in Runasimi. Runasimi means language of the people. So that's where the title of the film came from. It's in Quechua, actually.
Okay, so Quechua is the second official language in South America, and it's spoken by whom and where do they live?
Yeah, Quechua is the second official language in Peru, and it's actually the most spoken indigenous language in all of the Americas. 10 million speakers across 6 different countries, 4 million almost in Peru. And a lot of people have never heard of this language, but it's very vibrant and still living.
Yeah, so the indigenous population was the Incas?
Yeah, it was actually also the language of the Incas. It was used by the Incas, and the Incas had, as you know, a big empire, so they were in many countries, what we know as countries now. So the language is spoken in Colombia, in Ecuador, in Bolivia, in Argentina, Chile, and in Peru.
Yeah, so in Peru, did you learn the language, or is it just very similar to Spanish and you would understand it?
Actually, when I was going to school, I was taught that Quechua was a dead language, such as Latin. So until I went to university, I didn't learn about how alive the language of Quechua is. It's still a language in resistance, and according to UNESCO, it's an endangered language. But it's a language that, to me, was never shown how many people speak it in Peru and how important it is that we keep on speaking it.
Yeah. As you mentioned, 10 million people, and yet a blockbuster film has never been shown in Quechua. How come?
That's correct. And I think it's also because perhaps the industry has had this blind spot of not seeing the potential of dubbing their own films to Quechua. But I think it's also connected to how indigenous people in my country, in Peru, are treated. And like you mentioned, it's definitely recognized as a second official language in text, you know, according to the government. But in real practice, Quechua is not that respected. There's still a lot of stigmas against it. And it's not that much used in practice in everyday life in the cities. So sadly, that's one of the reasons why there's almost no films dubbed to Quechua. This will be the first big Disney film dubbed to Quechua that Fernando's looking to dub in Runasimi. But unfortunately, it has been an unattended audience, I think, in general, for the last years.
Yeah. So tell us what the film's about.
Of course. Imagine trying to save a language from extinction. That is what Fernando is trying to do. We follow him in his journey. Fernando is a voice actor from Cusco, Peru, who dreams of dubbing the Lion King to Quechua, the language of the Incas. And in this journey that he goes along with his young son, Dylan, he is tested on his commitment to his culture and his language.
So how did you find Fernando?
I actually met Fernando through his work. A friend of mine, a colleague documentary filmmaker actually from the US, was at my house, and she told me she wanted to show me a YouTube video. And she did full screen. I didn't see the title of the video. And she hit play, and it was the Hakuna Matata song, but in Quechua. It was Hakuchu Munaita. And when I saw this video, I couldn't believe it. You know, I couldn't believe the quality of the singing, the lip syncing, and everything was of very high quality. And I was able to contact the people behind this YouTube channel, and I thought I was going to meet a group of people. But to my surprise, when we met in person, it was only one guy. It was Fernando doing the voice of Timon and Pumbaa, and he would get his son Dylan to do the voice of Simba.
Disney has hundreds of films. Why did he pick The Lion King?
Fernando,
one of my favorites.
Yeah,
but I mean,
it's actually my favorite too, and it's also Fernando's favorites. And Fernando, the way that he's expressed his answer before when he's been asked this, he's mentioned that he doesn't play chess, but he knows that in chess you have to go for the king. And he went for the most known film by Disney, an animated classic like The Lion King that's 30 years ago, but still very, very much current. You know, everybody knows about The Lion King. So he went for that film because he also wanted to show the kids in the Quechua communities that, to him, film is a way to travel and dream. So he wanted them to see these landscapes of the Sahara and this story based on Macbeth, like The Lion King, that so they can see that it can also be dubbed to their own language, not only Spanish or English or other languages.
Yeah. So you gave the Hakuna Matata, I think, was that the original working title of your film? And then why did you decide to change it?
It actually was. The original working title was Hakuchu Munaita, which means let's go together nicely. That's what it translates to. And that was the original name, but then we decided to change it because we understood that the film was bigger than that. It was bigger than just the Disney backdrop and this pursuit. You know, the film explores different themes such as indigenous languages, identity. It's a father and son story. So because of all the themes that it touched upon with Fernando and Fernando's father, we were talking a lot about the title and how the title should be a little bit stronger and something that will just work around all the themes that are mentioned in the film. So Runasimi, we feel it's a way to introduce to people to the language in a very direct way because it's already the name of the language. Runasimi is the name of Quechua for Quechuans. So when people ask me, like, what is Runasimi, what is Quechua, you're already speaking it. By saying the title, Runasimi, you're already starting to speak in Quechua.
Okay, so how difficult was it for Fernando to get permission from the Walt Disney Company?
Okay, that's a great question, which if you allow me, I won't answer that much for your audience, to also invite them so they can come over tonight and see the story and see what happens. But I don't want to spoil too much of the story, but just so you know, Fernando is still in conversations with Disney. So it's still not, has not been possible to make this connection. But there's still a lot of things that Fernando has done, been able to do for his community in his own way, you know, taking matters to his own hands. So I think at the end of the day, that's what's important. You know, it's a film about community and it's a film about resilience. And many times people ask me if I would define the story as a coming of age. And I say that it is a coming of age, but for the father, not for the son. Because the son, Dylan, he's like an old soul. But Fernando, he has his inner child so alive that is the character that we in the film see grow and evolve and mature into what his dream is.
So have you screened it to Peruvians?
Yes, we have been able to screen it to Peruvians. We were so fortunate to be the first Peruvian documentary to have a world premiere, to have participated in the Tribeca Film Festival in the documentary competition. So that's where we had our world premiere last year in June. But luckily, we were able also to screen it to Fernando's community. We were able to screen the film to the community that opened their arms and allowed us to film there for many years, for 8.5 years. So we've been able to show it in Fernando's community, and also we've been able to participate in the Lima Film Festival, which was a great reception. You know, we were able to win 3 awards there, and people were really happy with, yeah, just the story that they were seeing on screen.
Yeah. So the film is in Spanish or Quechua, or and then subtitled in English, or?
It's a combination. The film that you will be able to see tonight at the library, it's a combination of Spanish, Quechua, and a little bit of English too. Mm. So that's, and it's all subtitled in English, of course. But there's also another version of the film that's completely dubbed to Quechua, because that was a very important thing for myself and the team and Fernando, that we would have a full dubbed version of Quechua so that the Quechua-speaking people can watch the film and understand the story fully. Because Quechua is a very oral language, so a lot of people might not read it or be able to write it, but they can sure speak it and understand it when they hear it. So that's why dubbing is such a good bridge and medium between, you know, this millennial language like Quechua and the newer generations.
Hmm. Well, congratulations. Thanks for being in Park City. Again, it's going to be screened for free, 7 p.m. at the Jim Sandy Auditorium. Everyone welcome to attend.
Thank you so much, and I appreciate the time for me to speak with your audience. And yes, I invite you all warmly to this film that we're going to screen tonight, and we're really excited to share it with the community in Park City.
Okay, Augusto, thank you.